Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Ross Lair Podcast. Today, Dr. Noel Cutterton is going to discuss Joseph Haydn and Kurt Weill. Noel, I'd like you to tell me a little bit about Haydn. Could you tell me about the man?
Haydn could be called the quiet man of classical music. He lived a quiet, unobtrusive life, and yet his music has left a huge impact on the world of music. He also could be described as a man that went from rags to riches. He was born in a small town called Rohau on the Austrian border with Hungary. His father made and fixed cartwheels, and they had very little money when he was growing up. But he and his family used to sing a lot together as children. He was in luck. One day, a relative visited the family and realised he was a great singer. This relative was a man that taught choirs. This relative trained him as a chorister, and he was very good at it, and he ended up in a choir in Vienna. He was an invertebrate prankster, and one day during choir practice, he cut off the pigtail of a fellow chorister's hair in front of him. After a severe beating by the boss, he was thrown out on the street, and he had to spend the next 10 years eking out an existence as a part-time teacher and as assistant to some famous singing teachers. That's how he earned his living.
Was there money to be made as a chorister back then?
No, very little. And you see, as a chorister, your voice will break. Your voice will break at 14 or 15 anyway, so it's a short life. But nonetheless, if you're good at that, you've a start made on a musical career. In 1728, he struck lucky. He got a job as a musical director of music in the household of a fabulously wealthy member of the Hungarian nobility, a guy called Prince Esterházy. He stayed in this job for the next 30 years. He oversaw the resident musicians, and his main job was to provide a steady stream of new music, be it orchestral, chamber music, choral, operatic and religious, almost on a weekly basis. This man just loved music, and he had a big family. So every week they'd throw concerts, and Haydn had to produce the music and produce the music for it. Now, he always wanted to get married, and as soon as he had got a steady income, he began to search for a woman whom he hoped would love him, keep house, have lots of children, and support him in his musical endeavours. In all these hopes, he ended up being bitterly, bitterly disappointed. He knew a family called the Kellers, they were from Vienna, and he fell in love with one of the daughters. Unfortunately, she did not reciprocate, and she left to become a nun. However, Mr. Keller, the father of these girls, reckoned that Haydn was a good catch, and he persuaded the poor, inexperienced Haydn that he should marry a second daughter, a girl called Anna Maria. And that's where Haydn made his big, big error. The marriage was a disaster from the start. She was jealous, quarrelsome, and a bigot. Unfortunately, they lived in conservative Vienna, where there was no divorce, so they had to remain married until she died. She made no effort to love him, and worst of all, took no interest in his music. He complained. She does not care a straw whether her husband is a musician or a cobbler. His friends noted, out of pure malice, she often used the handwritten manuscripts of his music as parchment paper for her pastry trays, or else maybe she shred them and used them to curl her hair.
Did she have a family with him?
No, they had no children. The quiet-spoken, mild-mannered Haydn used to call her that infernal beast. During all the years he worked in the Esterházy family, he led a busy, ordered, productive and largely uneventful life. And largely because he was so unhappily married, he spent all his time at the music business. And they had no children, even though it was something he desperately wanted. But on the plus side of all of that, he was so good and so dedicated to the music that he was free from all commercial pressures. Like, he was well paid for his job and his genius blossomed. He was largely isolated completely from the outside world and left to his own devices to develop his skills. In his own words, he used to say, "I was forced to become original." His musical output was phenomenal. He wrote music in nearly every genre. He wrote about 104 symphonies, and although he did not invent symphonies, he became known as the father of the symphony. Some of the best known ones of them are the Surprise Symphony and the Farewell Symphony, as well as several. Well, he was in London toward the end of his life. He went to London and he wrote several more of them. He also more or less invented the string quartet, and he wrote a staggering 90 of them. Imagine 90 of them. And many of those are still played regularly. He also composed about 15 operas. He thought they were his best works, but the musicologists judged that they were not, and they have since become overshadowed by much better opera composers. If that wasn't enough, he also dashed off about 100 songs. In 1790, his boss died, and Haydn was dismissed. But at this stage, Haydn and the boss...
Why would that have been? Why would he be dismissed?
He was... Because the boss died, and this man that took over that family wasn't as interested in his music as his... I think it was his brother, was, and dismissed him. But at that stage, Haydn didn't care. He was now famous for his music and was already wealthy. The man who hired him for all those 30 years, they became, even though musicians were meant to be sort of lowly members of the family, they became close friends. And Esterhazy signed over the rights. In theory, the music that Haydn wrote was his music, but he signed it all. He signed the rights over to Haydn. So Haydn was independently wealthy at this stage. But he was not ready to come. He was not ready to retire. He could well have retired, but he wasn't ready to retire yet.
And what age would he have been at this stage?
Oh, Lord, he must have been in his 60s. He was in his 60s. But he wasn't ready to retire, and he let it be known to the public that he was open for commissions. But he was inundated with offers of work. They came from everywhere for him. One of the offers was that he'd go to England and do a series of concerts and maybe compose a little. He ended up going twice, and each trip was highly successful. And he ended up being even richer than he was before. He was feted wherever he went. Two of his last compositions were oratorios. An oratorio is just a long piece of music, often with a sacred setting, lots of singing and choruses, like an opera, only it's done on stage. The two oratorios were called The Creation and The Seasons. They're both chock-a-block with great music and contain some of his best. And we're going to listen to a short snippet from the second one, The Seasons. It's a piece from McQuire, and the piece is called Come, Holder, Lents, and translated, Come, Gentle Spring. It's called The Seasons. It's typical of Haydn's gentle approach to his music.
That was Come, Holder, Lents, sung by the Monteverdi Choir, directed by John Elliott Gardiner. Noel, I just want to ask a question here. When Haydn was working for Prince Esterhazy, was he teaching the children to play music or what?
No. Prince Esterhazy was a music lover. He just loved music. And he had a huge big castle, and he used to entertain his family and his friends every week with some kind of music. And it was Haydn's job to supply the music, fresh original music, each week or whenever it was required. And that's what he did. He wasn't teaching, he was composing music. And in theory, that music, because he was an employee of the Esterhazy family, the music should belong to them. But in fact, the two men became great friends, even though Haydn was a much lower social order than Esterhazy. But the two were such friends that Esterhazy said it was his music. It was Haydn's music, and Haydn became well off and prosperous because of that decision.
But what I want to ask here is, if he was working for Esterhazy, did he sign something that said that the music didn't belong to him anymore?
I presume they did. I don't know.
It's
just it's recorded that Esterhazy was quite prepared to let Haydn own his own music. Well, that's what happened, and then he wrote.
And was that a common thing back then, that you would have a professional musician doing stuff like that?
Well, it was common that very well-off people had their own in-house musicians. Very common.
Could you give me an example of anybody else who did?
Well, sure, Mozart for a while used to do commissions for... And most composers were working on commission for some aristocrat or church person all the time. Where else did they get their money? Where else did they get their work from?
I just presumed it was performances, but...
Not so much. But Haydn was lucky in that this man, Esterhazy, was such a decent and generous man that and kept him employed for 30 long years, very quietly, never had to worry about commerce, never had to worry about selling stuff, never had to worry about filling a hall. It was all done. So in one sense, he used to call it a gilded cage. Because in one sense it was great, but in the other sense he was completely isolated from the world, with no commercial pressures. So he had to do his own thing, which he did quite happily.
So basically, Esterhazy was like a patron. He was promoting him.
Well, Esterhazy had a lot of employees, farmers, ploughmen, soldiers, I presume. He was just another employee, and his job was to do the music for the family.
Noel, would you care to tell me a little bit about Kurt Weill?
German composer Kurt Weill is a bit unusual in that he was trained in classical music, but he always wanted to make the transition into a genre that included jazz, cabaret and popular music and Broadway shows. His music often lampooned and satirised contemporary life, and while his writings were often very funny, he showed a deep felt sympathy for the destitute and the poor and the people left behind by society. He was a Jew, born in Germany in 1900, and by the time he was 20, he was already an opera coach and conductor. By 22, he was writing lots of music, including symphonies and incidental music for socially radical plays. But they made no impact on the music scene, and they kind of vanished. I don't hear much of them ever since. By the time he was 26, this would be 1926, he had written a few operas, again with little or no success. He was not happy with the rules of opera composition. He wanted to write real operas that incorporated and integrated music, drama, spoken words and songs. He also held the ideal that music should serve a socially useful purpose. In 1927, when he was 27, he met the left-wing playwright, a guy called Brecht. He was a well-known playwright, still is. This fateful collaboration led to fame for both men. Brecht was the one who was a few years older than Weill and was already well-known for his plays before the Nazis came into prominence. They collaborated on a few projects, and then they hit the jackpot with a big hit in 1928. Brecht adopted a famous opera ballet, The Beggar's Opera. It was written way back in 1728 in England. The original plot dealt with the realities of London lowlife and was a satire on political life at the time. Brecht brought the work up to date and set it in his own time. They called this opera the Threepenny Opera, and it dealt with a Germany dominated by political hooliganism. Brecht's sardonic script is a biting and bitter criticism of capitalism, greed, corrupt civil servants, where money is God and personal advancement is the whole purpose of life. Weill's music, really moving and spiky music, is based on a combination of jazz and cabaret. The premiere was not an outstanding success, but after a few performances it became very popular, until the Nazis came into power then and banned it in 1933.
I just want to ask there, when you're talking about Brecht and you're talking about Kurt Weill, that was a very, very decadent Berlin back then.
Yes.
Did they have any sort of sexual persuasions? Were they straight guys?
Both of them were married. Yeah, and Weill played a significant role in some of their music as well. I haven't dealt with it here. Both were married. This opera has not dated at all, and it still retains a powerful punch. It is regularly performed and is noted for some great tunes. Its most famous song has to be Mack the Knife. The two men continued to collaborate on several other projects, but they never achieved the same success as they had done with the Threepenny Opera. The great partnership between the two of them began to get frayed at the edges. Weill was always the dominant partner, and he became increasingly concerned about the evangelical nature of Bleck's left-wing views. Weil remarked that he was not prepared to set the Communist Manifesto to music, which is what Brecht kind of wanted to do. Remember, we're in the 1930s, when the Nazis were coming to power in Germany. Weil's relationship with the Nazis, which was never good, deteriorated further. An early performance of a new work, Seil Beresi, was interrupted by Nazi thugs around the time of the burning of the Reichstag. Weil's prominent place in the music world was an embarrassment to the Nazis, and Weil and his wife had to flee Germany. In 1938, the Nazis labelled him and all Jewish composers as composers of degenerate music, and the Minister of Culture declared that Weil's music was a corrupting influence. Brecht and Weil met once more in Paris when they both had to flee Germany, and they collaborated one more time in a song cycle called The Seven Deadly Sins, which only met with moderate success. Weil then went to the States in 1935, and he was full of ideas and optimism about future prospects in America. He was convinced that he had the talents and had the musical ability to make it big in Broadway. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that way. His music did not go down well. He always considered himself as a composer with a social mission, and he never really achieved this. America weren't that interested. And also his sort of brushes with socialism and all that thing, kind of stuff did not go down well with the Americans at all. Okay. Yeah, he got to America in 1935. So he had got out before the war. But all the strain was all this striving and striving. He had some moderate successes, but no great ones. The strain was too much for him, and he died at 50. From a chronic heart condition. His entire estate was valued less than $1,000 when he died. In other words, he died pretty well penniless. His wife was Lotte, who had played a big part in his career, felt that his contribution to musical theatre was undervalued. She arranged that an English version of the Threepenny Opera be written, and it opened in Broadway in 1954, and it ran for 3 years. This touched off a Weil revival, and it continues to this day. His music is played regularly ever since. This time, I say it's easy to pick a piece from Weil to play. We will listen to Mac the Knife. It's from the Threepenny Opera. The song has been sung by nearly every major star, and we will listen to a version of by Frank Sinatra.
The shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has Mac Heath, dear, and he keeps it way out of sight. When the shark bites his teeth, dear, scarlet billows, they start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears Mac Heath, dear, so there's never, never, never a trace of red. On the sidewalk, one Sunday morning, lies a body oozing life. Someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone perchance be Mac the Knife? From a tugboat by the river going slow, a cement bag dropping down, and the cement's just for the weight, dear. I bet you Mackey's, yeah, he's back in town. My man Louis Miller, he split the scene, babe, after drawing out all the bread in his stash. spends just like a pimp now. Did our boy do, did he do something right? Old Satchmo, Louis Armstrong, Bobby Darin, they did this song nice, and Lady Ella too. They all sang it with such feeling, that old blue eyes can't add nothing new. But with Quincy's big band right behind me, swinging hard jack, I know I can't lose. When I tell you about Mac the Knife, babe, it's an offer you can't refuse. We got George Benson, Newman Foster. Here we got the Brecker Brothers and Hamp bringing up the rear. All those bad cats and more are in this band now, with the greatest sounds you're ever gonna hear. Ah, Suki Tawdry, old Jenny Diver, Polly Beecham, and Miss Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms on the right there. Now that Mackie, yes, Mackie, I said Mackie, that bad man Mackie, my man Mackie, you better know that.
I thought this version of Mac the Knife, sung by Frank Sinatra, in collaboration with Quincy Jones and his big band, might just make you smile. Keep on listening to TRP.